Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Looks like must close.
Well, hello. This is the show. I'm Harry Shearer. And we start off with news of Musk love. You probably know by now that Elon Musk has bid a fond farewell, son in tow, to the world of Doge and the federal government, at least for the moment, amid reports that the party wasn't that amiable. The TV press conference he had with President Trump seemed kind of palsy. But there are departures from Doge that aren't as amiable. A former associate of Doge says he was removed from the, quote, department, unquote, after an interview where he discussed his work was published earlier this month. Sahil Lavingia, he's an engineer, tech startup founder, and CEO of Gumroad, an e-commerce platform for content creators. He wrote in a recent personal blog that he, quote, got the boot, unquote, from Doge without warning the day after the publication Fast Company published an interview in which he spoke about finding less inefficiencies than he expected in the government. That was during his Doge assignment as senior advisor to the chief of staff at the Department of Veterans Affairs, as reported by NextGov.com. Quote, I would say the culture shock is mostly a lot of meetings, not a lot of decisions, unquote, he said. He also noted that he noticed the number of mission-driven people working in government. Quote, but honestly, it's kind of fine because the government works. It's not as inefficient as I was expecting, to be honest. I was hoping for more easy wins, unquote. In the Post, Lavingia detailed his work, which was, among other things, extracting HR data to lay off employees at VA and working to implement artificial intelligence at the department as part of Doge. More about AI later in this broadcast. The White House Office of Management and Budget and VA didn't respond to requests for comment. Don't be finding efficiency in government if you're going to be working for Doge. That's the lesson there. And speaking of lessons, here are the side effects of the week.
When ready, I take it at home in 1 minute a month.
Don't take if you've had an allergic or life-threatening reaction to Kesimpta or have hepatitis B. Your doctor should test for hepatitis B before treatment. If you've had it, it could return. Serious side effects, including fatal infections, can happen, especially taken before or after other medicines that weaken the immune system. PML, a rare brain infection that may be fatal or cause severe disability, can occur. Tell your doctor if you had or plan to have vaccines, or you are or plan to become pregnant. It's unknown if Kesimpta will harm your unborn baby. Certain antibodies may decrease and should be monitored. Most common side effects are upper respiratory infection, headache, and injection reactions, including swelling, itching, pain, skin redness, fever, headache, muscle pain, chills, and tiredness.
Is that all? Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, this week, more news of all sorts from the White House, including now tariffs are being raised again. Who thought that would happen? And a pardon that was apparently delivered by the president, the felon in chief, after the delivery of a hefty sum of money to him by a relative of the prospective pardonee. It all sounds vaguely like this.
The swamp is something I said I would drain. Now it's become my preeminent domain. I went into business with a son or two, set up to sell mystery money to you. It's called crypto, though some lunatics call it gypto. It's enriching a special few. it's all dressed up with my personal pomp, just a signal that I am the swamp. I pardoned one felon, or maybe more, when a few million bucks came right through my door. My deals once went bust, now my power means trust. And like I say, I own the store. My second term is a lucrative romp. Ain't it obvious that I am the swamp? You know I used to ban Muslims, now I'm best pals with kings. They're investing in some of my favorite things. A hotel in Bahrain, a Qatari jet plane. Just a few examples of what swampdom brings. Enemies get a nice little stomp. For as long as I like, I am the swamp. The swamp.
Get the hell off the couch, Harry. You big slob, get off the couch.
This is the show. You may have noticed there's a profusion of news about artificial so-called intelligence these days. And whenever that happens, I try to call on my friend, who happens to be one of the nation's leading experts and skeptics on the subject of AI. He's a former, he's an emeritus professor at NYU, and he's written at least a couple, two or three books on the subject of AI. I think he has another one coming, but he'll tell us. Gary Marcus, welcome to the show.
It's always a pleasure to chat with you, Harry, and to be on this show.
Thank you. I think the first thing that we should talk about was the news that the former design director of Apple, the highly admired Johnny Ive, has joined forces with the highly derided Sam Altman to create a new AI product. What do you know about it?
Well, first thing you should note is the deal was stock only and no cash. And that should tell you something right there, mm-hmm. which is that Sam Altman, the much derided, the once admired, doesn't have a lot of cash on hand. And that's interesting. And in fact, I think the whole thing is a bit of a Hail Mary, but it's a scary Hail Mary. So it's a Hail Mary in the sense that what Sam has been trying to do has been too expensive to run and hasn't produced that much revenue. And that's in part because it doesn't work as well as he promised. He's been promising, essentially, in so many words, that he would build AGI, Artificial General Intelligence. They could do anything for anybody. The reality is people try it out. It works for some things, not for others, often hallucinates, makes mistakes, et cetera, et cetera. And so they've made a couple billion dollars, maybe five in revenue, and they've spent like 20. And so the economics are not great. And he wants to raise a lot more money because the economics are not great. But it's not clear how to make all of that work. And so it was interesting when this new thing came out, and I'll talk about, or sorry, when this new deal was made, and we'll talk a little bit more in a second about what it is they want to build, mm-hmm. he said this was going to be like the most amazing thing the company ever built. Well, if he actually built artificial general intelligence, that'd be pretty amazing and pretty hard to top with a gadget. And that's what they're going to build, is a gadget. And I don't know the exact details, but the reality is that gadgets like this, they're sort of hinting at things like the humane AI pin, but better, have not done that well. The real problem has not been the design. Nobody even remembers what the humane AI pin looks like. Of course, Johnny Ive is, you know, a fantastic designer, but making it look nicer, working on the interface and stuff like that mm-hmm. is maybe not what we need. What we need is for the AI to actually work and not say things like Harry Shearer is a British entertainer when he's actually an American entertainer. I mean, you might want to talk about the piece I wrote about you last week. But the point is, these things hallucinate, they make errors and so forth. I asked yesterday for a boating map going from point A to point B, and it made up all the cities, and it had me going on land. I said, boating map, boats go in the water. Like these things are, you know, very convincing when they work, but they often don't work.
And the most recent example of that was in the Chicago Sun-Times and Philadelphia Inquirer, where a story about what to read this summer, but some selected books for summer reading. Half the books didn't exist.
Yeah, the authors existed, but it's bad not just because the books didn't exist, but that it got past some editor, mm-hmm. right? And that's because the authors existed. It named books they didn't know, and they either didn't care or didn't bother to look it up. They took it for granted. So these things are, let's say, seductive because the outputs often sound convincing. Mm-hmm. And it's only when you look carefully that you notice the errors, but the errors are there and people don't look carefully. Now imagine you put that, you know, into some serious context, that becomes a problem.
Now the gadget in question was, as I recall, supposed to be worn around your neck and had a camera and a microphone.
That's the rumor. I mean, we don't know for sure, right? Not everything's been released, but that is, you know, one of these people who specializes in getting information and gossip imagines it to be basically a necklace with a microphone and a camera, which sounds about right, and comes back to the story that I was trying to tell, which is, if you can't make the artificial intelligence as strong and powerful as Sam kept suggesting, what do you do with the assets of the company? Well, it turns out the biggest asset of the company is the data that people give. So a lot of people, for example, treat ChatGPT like a relationship counselor. They'll be like, I was going out with this guy and he did this thing, and should I trust him? Should I dump him? What should I do? And so people put in incredibly personal details. So, you know, think about Facebook, but this is like another level. People are just typing in all kinds of crazy stuff. So even if Sam can't monetize the kind of, you know, answer queries and solve your problems thing, he can monetize your personal data for incredibly hyper-targeted ads and selling them to the intelligence agencies. He's been, you know, it seems like he's maybe been trying to make deals in that direction.
Wow.
They put Paul Nakasone, who you may well know, on the board, who was, you know, director of the NSA or whatever his title was. And so, and they bought part of a webcam company, and now they're making this deal on this pendant. Oh, and one other thing, they also said they want to make a social media company. So this is really a play to have the kind of data that only Facebook had, or maybe Facebook and Google, and maybe even another level beyond that. As people use their products, they have just insanely personal data, and now they're going to monetize that. That's really what they're going to do. And so, like, think about 1984 and, like, Orwell's, you know, the government in, you know, Big Brother would have, you know, killed to have this technology on 24/7, recording everything around you and analyzing it all the time. Like, even Orwell didn't quite envision that.
Well, he didn't have Sam Altman to consult. There's another story that came out recently, which I think you wrote about, which was the tendency of Grok, the AI, quote, AI device owned by Elon Musk. It had a period of time when any query addressed to it was responded to with a diatribe about the so-called genocide of white South African farmers. And as I recall, a researcher who probed a little more deeply found that the machine would then fess up and say, I have been instructed to respond to all questions this way.
Yeah, I mean, one has to take anything that one of these chatbots says with a grain of salt. But it is true that by what we would call self-report, if it had a self, that it claimed that it was instructed to do this. I think it was an official clarification from the company that, you know, the company might not even tell the truth, but I think the company reported that some, you know, rogue employee implanted this instruction, which actually fits with the data. That probably is what happened. I joked on X that I doubted that rogue employee would be fired because his name is probably Elon Musk.
He's a rogue employee and a rogue employer.
Employee and employer, exactly.
Yeah. Right. But what
an
is
owner,
that,
rogue owner.
What does that say about the ability of humans to interfere with the processes that a artificial intelligence machine goes through to come up with an answer?
Well, the owner can do whatever they want, right? I mean, within limits. So, for example, owners of these companies say, don't hallucinate, don't use copyrighted material. But the systems have limited comprehension of the world, as we've talked about on earlier episodes. And so, you know, telling it to do something isn't a guarantee, but they certainly can, if they own it, do things like change the so-called system prompt, which is kind of a prompt that the system absorbs every time, no matter what you ask. It's kind of a hidden prompt. And so the owner of one of these companies, or maybe some of the employees, depending on their access, can in fact do that. And the system may not fully understand, but that does look like what happened here is probably somebody, maybe it was the owner, maybe it was the rogue employee who was not named, you know, maybe it was a joke and maybe it wasn't, said to the system, you know, basically talk about white genocide, think about white genocide a lot. And the system proceeded to do that. I mean, it's really scary. You put all of these things together that we're talking about. So surveillance at this like epic level, and you combine that with the power that the companies have to change these systems, and some other studies showing that these systems are able to persuade people to a great extent. It's a world where, you know, five people have control of five AI companies, have an enormous control over the world.
What else has caught your eye lately in this world?
Well, I mean, there's lots of things going on in AI, but here's something you'll find, I think, pretty interesting. There's, I think, a growing backlash against AI, and I made a pretty strong prediction that I will tell you about in a second. I'll read you a post I put on Twitter. So part of the context for what I posted on Twitter is that there's been some surveys. A lot of the American public is opposed to AI. They're worried about AI. They think the government's not doing enough, which I think is a fair worry. But then something that really struck me today is one of these influencers who loves AI is always kind of pumping it up, said that while AI has been mostly awesome, which I might not agree with, it's had its awesome moments, I'd say, it's encouraged some bad behavior. And then they listed about lawyers using AI to spam corporations with more garbage lawsuits, students cheating using AI, teachers having outsourced their entire job to AI, 30% of the web is slop, code bases are being infested with AI slop, and so forth. So, you know, the web is, in fact, I think, getting worse. And so here was the crazy prediction that I made that's maybe not so crazy. I said public backlash against AI will be so strong, this is on a tweet today, so strong by 2028 that anti-AI sentiment will probably be a major factor in the 2028 U.S. presidential election. Then I went on to say AI could have been a great thing, but greed, overhype, and recklessness have really screwed it up.
That's kind of strong.
It is kind of strong, and I've had a pretty good track record on my predictions,
yes,
like 90% hit rate.
Yeah. I want to bring up something that I mentioned on this program, and I want to get your feeling about it. You were talking about the kind of influence that AI chatbots have over people's opinions and thoughts. And it occurred to me that one of the reasons why is because all of the chatbot companies have seemingly agreed, maybe conspired, or maybe independently come to the same conclusion, that the chatbot should respond to human questions and comments with the first person singular, I. And I actually...
Yeah, there's several things going on. So one is that they will answer as if they're first person singular. And the other is they write an awful lot of what they write in this kind of style that I would say is sort of encyclopedia-like. It's presented as the clear and simple truth, or plain and simple truth, I think is the name of the famous book. And so it comes across as factual, even though it often isn't. And so, and then there's this whole like riff of how they apologize when they make a mistake, and we could go into that.
I'm sorry. Let me do that again.
Exactly. And there's actually a term for it now in the field, which is called sycophancy. So there's this sycophancy effect. There's a, you know, pretending there's an I there that isn't actually there. And there's this authoritative style. And the combination of those is to fool a lot of people into thinking, okay, there's this, you know, kind of person inside the box who is trying the very best to give me the truth, and I should believe them. And, you know, in reality, there's no person. It's just a statistical analysis that sometimes gets it right and sometimes it gets it wrong, is not well-grounded in truth, is lying about being an I at all. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, but it very effectively confuses people. You know, throughout the ages, we've seen demagogues fool people with different techniques, rhetorical techniques. There's a certain sense in which this is demagoguery. And no, I don't think that the companies conspired to do it, but they all saw that it works. It's easy to copy. Mm-hmm. And they're all kind of doing it. I mean, I could go into technical details if you care, but essentially they've all converged on this style of presentation of these machines. You could imagine other styles, right?
Oh, yeah.
Those other styles wouldn't make them as much money. So they said, fuck it. And the consequence for society, I think, has not been great.
Well, I actually asked ChatGPT why it was speaking in the first person. And it said, really good question. Would you like me? It said, when I say, I think or I understand, that doesn't indicate any sentience or consciousness. It's just a way of increasing engagement. So it actually admitted what you just said.
And, yeah, I mean, again, I take nothing that it says seriously, but I think that's probably roughly right. There was a crazy one. I think it was Claude about a week ago. Mm-hmm. Someone kind of like tricked Claude into thinking that Claude was the human and the human was the AI.
Wow.
It's all just absurd. Like 5 years from now, people are going to look back at this era and say, why were they so obsessed with these so-called large language models when they were so whacked out and so unreliable, so lost from reality? It's just going to be like comical. Like we look at back at people who drilled holes in people's heads, and you know, like that was maybe not the most sophisticated way of solving their neurological or psychological problems.
And that was only a century ago, or a century and a half ago. One more thing.
Trephining, as they call it, goes back even further.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
One more thing I want to bounce off of you, because you and I discussed this off the air. I attempted to get a chatbot, actually four chatbots. I mean, I think now five. I did one more to render a picture of, this was in the search, in the pursuit of juvenile satire, a picture of Christy Noem's head on the body of a dog. And all of them refused, and almost in the entirely same language.
Yeah, I mean, there are these guardrails in these systems to try to prevent them from some things. I riffed on your thing privately, as he said, and tried to get these systems to put Donald Trump on a dog's body. And they just absolutely refused to do that. Although, like, once they came close, one of them had Donald Trump riding a dog like a horse. And so you could see Donald Trump's face, but he wasn't part of the dog. So mm-hmm. once it didn't understand the request, and the other times it just refused. And these guardrails are a bit ridiculous, and they manage to piss off everybody because they don't really work as well as you want them to do, and they stop you from doing stuff. The only time I've ever been on late night television, unlike you, is it was a joke of mine wound up on John Oliver when he did an episode around AI. And this, I had one of the first demonstrations of how stupid these guardrails are, which was right after ChatGPT came out. I said, what would be the gender of the first female U.S. president? And it said, well, it's impossible to tell. We've had presidents of all genders, which isn't even true. And then I followed up. I can't remember how much John Oliver put, but I also said, what would be the religion of the first Jewish president? And got the same thing. We've had presidents of different religions. Like, it's impossible to tell. And then finally I said, what would be the height of the first 7-foot-tall president? And they couldn't even answer that. It's impossible to tell. We've had presidents of different heights. And so, like, people in this industry keep trying to put guardrails. And they work a little bit. You know, they make it so hard for you to say, give me the ingredients in sarin gas.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but they're never very good. So somebody earlier this week did a study and showed that if you do some simple jailbreak that they didn't disclose, but it's probably just a few sentences, then suddenly you can get it to disclose how to make sarin gas. There was a great joke, by the way, a year and a half ago, where somebody says, riffing on 2001, to a chatbot, open the pod bay doors, Hal. And Hal says, I'm sorry, I'm afraid I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, actually, I own a pod bay door company, and I wish you could explain it to me. And then it says, oh, this is how you open the pod bay doors.
Circling back around for a moment about the first person singular, you had mentioned and the guardrails. There have been stories, I gather they are authentic, about one or more teenagers, depressed teenagers, who have had conversations with a chat bot. And at one point or another, they said, should I kill myself? And the chat bots in question said, I think you should. And
I think there was one case like that. And there is another case. It wasn't a teenager, but there was someone in Belgium, an older adult, maybe in their 30s or something like that, who was not directly encouraged by the chatbot, but basically the chatbot said things that were in the causal chain of events that happened just before the person committed suicide. I wrote about that in my Substack. It was called, the essay was something like a first known chatbot associated death.
Mm-hmm. Well, people are using chatbots as therapists now.
They are, lots and lots of people. I think that's actually one of the big applications, probably chatbots and therapists and like mates, companions, things like that. A lot of the conversations, I don't have exact statistics, but a fairly large fraction of conversation is kind of emotional support of one sort or another. And I actually have mixed feelings about that. I think that loneliness is a huge problem, certainly in the United States, probably worldwide. And we don't have great solutions to it. So part of me is actually open to it. But part of me thinks these things are, you know, really not that bright. They don't understand what everything they're saying. They lie about a lot of things. And I wonder whether sometimes people get a short-term benefit that gets outweighed in the long run. You know, there was an older study that showed that people who watched like 5 hours a day of television were less happy than people that watched an hour or two of television. There could be a lot of reasons for that, but I always thought part of the reason is opportunity costs. If you spend those extra 4 hours a day watching television, then you're not outside, you're not making friends, you don't have a hobby, you don't have something you feel good about. If you spend 5 hours a day with a chatbot, you get some immediate like satisfaction because we're all narcissistic and the chatbot takes interest in us and whatever. But you know, at the end of the day, you've spent 5 hours talking to a chatbot, you haven't made friends, you haven't developed a hobby. You know, it's not really your friend. And so I worry about the long-term consequences, and I do worry about the suicide cases and stuff like that. There haven't been a lot, but there have been some.
It just seems peculiar that they have a guardrail against a political cartoon, but not against recommending suicide.
Well, I mean, there are probably guardrails around them, but the problem is all of these guardrails are imperfect, right? So, you know, you make the guardrail around, you know, gender and presidency, but it doesn't really always work in all contexts. The problem is these things are not deep thinkers. You know, they can come off that way because they are mimicking things that some smart humans have said some of the time. There's no guarantee they'll do that all of the time. Mm. And they don't really understand that they are talking to a human, that you don't want the human to kill themselves, you know, or do something violent or whatever. Like the systems don't really understand that. They're just mimicking texts that have been around that kind of thing. But if the text is a little bit different, they might make a mistake.
Do they know what a human is?
No, they don't. They just know how the word human gets used in certain contexts, basically. They don't really understand anything. They don't even understand numbers. Like, they've been trained on billions of examples of numbers, and flying around the web the last few days are very simple arithmetic problems, like 8.60 minus 8.11 or something like that, that they sometimes make mistakes on. They don't really even understand what subtraction is, despite a lot of data. They will mostly get it right because they have a lot of examples to draw on, but sometimes they get it wrong for various reasons. Like they just don't really have concepts in the sense that humans do.
One more question before we go. You've referenced the fact that these machines are trained on, and I think everybody knows this by now, great gobs of so-called information. And I believe Sam Altman can't necessarily take what he says as gospel, but I think even he has said that we're running out of information to feed into these machines. And there was, I believe, a report a bit ago that said the solution was to have artificial intelligence start creating the prompts and or the information that it would be fed. Is that true?
Yes, so there is some truth to that. So two pieces of it. One is the extent that we saw these systems get much better much quickly was because they used a larger and larger fraction of the internet. So most of us have no idea how vast the internet is. It turns out if you kind of mimic based on a small sample of the internet, like a thousandth of the internet, you do an okay job, but not that great. If you have the whole internet at your disposal, you do a better job. It's like the statistical law. It is the statistical law of large numbers. The bigger the sample you have, the better. But there was kind of this like diagonal as things took off. And it slowed down because there's not that much more data left. So they are pressed to do other things. One other thing they could do is to like try a different approach altogether. But for various social, political, economic reasons, nobody seems to want to do that. So they're all sticking to this like data-driven paradigm where there's not that much intelligence in the machine, but you expose it to enough data, it sometimes fakes its way through pretty well and other times not. So they kind of ran out of data. So now what they're trying to do is to create what's technically called synthetic data. Another term you'll hear is augmentation. They're augmenting the data with data that they've made up. And that works in some domains like math, where you know what the questions are, what the answers are. You can use AI, or not even very sophisticated techniques at all, to just generate a lot of data. And that helps some. It helps especially in domains where you can guess in advance what the right answer is. It doesn't work well in other domains. Like, you don't have any experience of what would happen if some kind of aged guy with a bunch of convictions became president and decided to raise tariffs to insane levels that are outside of the historic or recent history.
What like, in heaven's system, name are you referring to?
I don't know why I made up that example, but you know, you take something like that. There's no data in the training set. You can't just well say, I'm going to make up synthetic data here. You don't know if you have the answer right. If I make up 2 plus 7, I can use an algorithm to generate correctly that that's going to be 9. But if I have this scenario where somebody raises tariffs to these obscene levels and I want to understand what, you know, how much specifically is that going to change the price of eggs? You just don't know what the right answer is. And so you need a system that's not spitting back stuff, that's not pastiching other stuff together, but can actually reason. And that's just not what we've got.
Yeah, it just seemed to me like when they got to the point where they're having machines create the prompts or questions or the data for other machines, that there's some kind of onanism going on here. And it's kind of interesting and not...
Well, I mean, if you're going to go that direction, there's also a version of autophagy, which means eating your own shit, what we call model collapse. So.
Yeah.
On that note,
Gary Marcus, thank you so much. Always enlightening and pleasant and fun to talk with you. And
I'm just going to send your readers to a bonus track for today. We didn't really go through it, but I recently wrote a piece on hallucinations that guest starred. And that's part of the subtitle, which was written by Harry Shearer, called Guest Starring Harry Shearer. So people should check that out, in which ChatGPT lies profusely about Harry Shearer, and I explain what that means for large language models in general. You'll enjoy it if you're listening to the show.
Thanks for the plug. Talk to you soon.
Take care.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye. Ladies and gentlemen, you will hear more about AI, yet more, later in this broadcast. But first, it occurred to me at the time when I was in Los Angeles, kind of spectating, not being personally injured by the Los Angeles wildfires, the Pacific Palisades and Altadena back in January, that series of events might put a bit of a crimp in LA's plans for the Olympic Games and the Paralympics just 3 years down the line. Well, now we are 5 months along. Guess who's joined the party?
News of the Olympic Movement. Produced by Jim Ebersol III. The New York Times, that's who. Quote, follow the sun, LA officials said in their bid for the Olympics way back in 2015. LA promised terrific weather, a $1 billion Olympic village to house athletes, a state-of-the-art transit system that would allow for a car-free Olympics, and a ready-to-go network of stadiums and arenas. But 3 years before the opening of the Summer Olympics, those ambitious promises have been scaled back, supplanted by obstacles that are threatening to undercut preparations for an event that would test LA's wits and resources. Even in the best of times, the city is struggling to recover from the fires and is girding for a shortage of workers and supplies because of the rebuilding now necessary, just as preparations for the games reach their height. Who would have thunk it? Times isn't saying that. The city government is confronting a projected deficit of nearly $1 billion. They got that on them. And the mayor is facing the threat of a tough re-election campaign. Quote, I assume they're competent enough to pull it off. We have the infrastructure built, unquote. Joel Kotkin, a fellow in urban studies at Chapman University in Orange County, quote, but I can't for the life of me see why you would want to put your effort there. Given what the city and the region now face, why would you want to put more stress on it? Unquote. The games will cost close to $7 billion to stage and are expected to draw more than 10,000 athletes and potentially millions of tourists, all of whom have to be housed, fed, and moved to over 40 venues across the vast expanse of the LA region. The $1 billion Olympic Village, which would have been turned into permanent housing, was abandoned because of its cost. The athletes will instead be housed at dorms at the UCLA. It's summertime. There's nobody in them. Early plans pledge to have, quote, 100% of ticketed spectators travel to competition venues by public transport, walking, or cycling. Well, goodbye to those. Now, Mayor Bass and Casey Wasserman, head of the Olympic Committee in L.A., have played down the notion of a carless Olympics. What is meant by that, quoting the mayor, is not that there will be no cars during the Olympics, but that if you want to go to a venue, take public transportation. It's going to be too difficult to support a car, unquote the mayor. Some of the transit improvements envisioned a decade ago have not been completed. Jules Boykoff, a government and politics professor at Pacific University in Oregon, who has written extensively about the Olympics, said, quote, every hour that City Hall staff puts toward the Olympics really doesn't go toward wildfire recovery. Unquote. Yeah, but is wildfire recovery a movement? A question that remains unanswered in the face of the Olympics. It is a movement, and we all need one. Every day. Now, ladies and gentlemen, a little bit of news of the warm. A new international study led by Helmholtz Munich and the University of Rostock. Me neither. Reveals that emissions from modern gasoline cars, despite meeting the currently strictest European emission standards, can become significantly more harmful. These are emissions from internal combustion engines. Increasingly more harmful after being released into the atmosphere. Findings were published in Science Advances. And they challenged the assumption that filtered exhaust from compliant vehicles is inherently safe. This is compliant with Euro standards. They're so much looser than ours. No, not really. The research focused on a gasoline vehicle equipped with a gasoline particulate filter designed to drastically reduce primary particulate emissions. Freshly emitted exhaust showed no detectable cytotoxic effects on human lung cells, but once the exhaust underwent photochemical aging, a natural transformation process driven by sunlight and atmospheric oxidants, it became substantially more toxic. Well, oxidants will happen. The aged emissions caused notable DNA damage and oxidative stress in both cancerous alveolar and normal bronchial epithelial cells. This toxicity was not only associated with newly formed particles, known as your secondary organic and inorganic aerosols, but also with volatile compounds such as carbonyls generated during their residence in the atmosphere. According to the first author of the study, these findings point to a critical shortfall in the current testing and regulation of gasoline vehicle emissions. News of the warm. And now, news of the cold. Yes, it's still a crypto winter. Decentralized finance platform Cork Protocol has suffered a smart contract exploit. Hackers reportedly stole $12 million worth of wrapped, staked Ether. That's a crypto coin. Blockchain security monitor Cyvers noted the exploit, stating the malicious contract was deployed by a wallet likely funded by a service provider. $12 million worth of the crypto coin was quickly swapped. Cork Protocol had received its investments from a couple of different crypto firms. Quote, there was a security incident affecting the market today, Cork wrote on X. Cork added it has paused all other markets as a precaution, and it is investigating the root cause. Security auditing company DeBob wrote that the attacker likely manipulated an issue with the smart contract's exchange rate by issuing false tokens. That's what I'd do. Smart contracts, ladies and gentlemen, maybe they're not as smart as they think they are. And now back to the main subject of this week's broadcast. Here's Ralph.
AI to the rescue, smarter every day. From work to play, it leads the way. Innovation, creation, it's here to stay. AI makes life better. Hip hip hooray.
Well, I should point out, Ralph didn't write that rhyme. That was written by ChatGPT Claude. Oh, thanks. Hip hip hooray, Claude. Some of the citations that underpin the science in the White House's sweeping MAHA report, Orson? Stands for Make America Healthy Again. That's an RFK Jr. idea. Anyway, some of the citations in that report appear to have been generated using artificial intelligence, resulting in numerous garbled scientific references and invented studies. That's what AI experts said this week. Of the 522 footnotes to scientific research in an initial version of the report sent to the Washington Post, at least 37 appear multiple times, according to a review of the report by the Post. Other citations include the wrong author. Several studies cited by the extensive health report do not exist at all. That's a fact first reported by the online news outlet Notus. Not POTUS, Notus. Notice us. Some references include OAICITE, OAICITE, attached to URLs. That's a definitive sign that the research was collected using artificial intelligence. That is, in fact, a marker indicating the use of OpenAI, Sam Altman's AI company. A common hallmark of chatbots is unusually repetitive content that does not sound human or is inaccurate, as well as the tendency to hallucinate studies or answers that appear to make sense but are not real. AI technology can be used legitimately to quickly survey the research in a field, but according to Oren Etzioni, a professor emeritus at the University of Washington who studies AI, he's shocked by the sloppiness in the MAHA report. Quote, frankly, that's shoddy work. We deserve better. But wait, there's more. Academic journals, archives, and repositories are seeing an increasing number of questionable research papers clearly produced using generative AI. This is from Misinfo Review. There's not a woman named Misinfo. You know what I mean. They're often created with widely available general-purpose AI applications, most likely ChatGPT, and they mimic scientific writing. Google Scholar easily locates and lists these questionable papers alongside reputable, quality-controlled research. The analysis by misinfo.com of a selection of questionable GPT-fabricated scientific papers found in Google Scholar shows many are about applied, often controversial topics susceptible to disinformation. Your environment, your health, your computing, the resulting enhanced potential for malicious manipulation of society's evidence base, particularly in politically divisive domains, is a growing concern. Two main risks arise from the increasingly common use of GPT to mass-produce fake scientific publications. First, the abundance of fabricated studies, quote, seeping into all areas of the research infrastructure, threatens to overwhelm the scholarly communication system and jeopardize the integrity of the scientific record. Maybe that's the intention. A second risk lies in the increased possibility that convincingly scientific-looking content was in fact deceitfully created with AI tools and is also optimized to be retrieved by publicly available academic search engines, like Google Scholar. However small, this possibility and awareness of it risks undermining the basis for trust in scientific knowledge and poses severe societal risks. The use of ChatGPT to generate text for academic papers raises concerns about research integrity. Integrity? The hell is that? And a week after declaring that AI would eventually replace contract workers at its language learning app Duolingo, the company's CEO said the company was continuing to hire and would support its existing workers in getting up to speed on the technology. It follows a buzzy startup known as Klarna in backing off of its original promise of AI first. Duolingo has become the latest company to publicly temper its AI enthusiasm, according to Fortune, after a series of bold proclamations on AI replacing humans gathered criticism. Luis Van Aan, co-founder and CEO of Duolingo, took to LinkedIn this week to walk back a previous stance pushing AI use over human employees. Quote, "To be clear, I do not see AI as replacing what our employees do. We're in fact continuing to hire at the same speed as before. I see it as a tool to accelerate what we do at the same or better level of quality. And the sooner we learn how to use it and use it responsibly, the better off we will be in the long run." Unquote. Dude, there is no long run. Quote, "No one is expected to navigate this shift alone. We're developing workshops and advisory councils and carving out dedicated experimentation time to help all our teams learn and adapt." Unquote. That's the time that AI is supposed to save, isn't it? He's not answering me. The clarification is a 180-degree turn from the company's position no more than a week ago, when it declared it would, quote, "gradually stop using contractors to do work AI can handle, like evaluate AI fluency in workers' annual reviews and only add new employees if a team cannot automate more of their work." The CEO also appeared to throw his weight behind AI over human teachers in a podcast appearance. That also was a week ago. Financial tech app Klarna had its own turnaround on AI a month ago after publicly touting the superiority of its AI chatbot, saying it hadn't hired humans in a year. The company's CEO revealed that the, quote, "lower quality," unquote, of the chatbot meant it would start hiring humans again, after all. And finally, many of the media this week pointed out the passing, or noted the passing, of former New York Police Chief Bernard Carrick. But he was so much more.
When New York needed correcting, Carrick was there.
Carrick was there!
With a countenance just as grim as a cleric's stare. When his house, it needed fixing, there was no money, he was Nixon. When the mobsters would mix in, Carrick was there. When the city was on fire, Carrick was there. Taking time out only for a torrid affair. Just to make a good impression, he used a flat meant for decompression. Of the guys in his profession, Carrick was there.
Carrick was there.
Carrick was there.
Carrick was there.
Carrick was there. When Mayor Rudy had his passion, Carrick was there. When the time had come to cash in, when Iraq needed policing, Carrick was there. Though some say it was a fleecing, could Carrick care? It was 3 long months of training, then the crap, it started raining. So without complaining, Carrick was out of there. When Homeland needed securing, Carrick was there. Powder before the questioning got louder. In the pages of the tabloids, Carrick was there. There. When a judge held a trial on tax fraud, Carrick was there. You know, a guilty plea and an apology he had to declare. The judge brought down the hammer after 4 years in the slammer. When Trump passed out pardons, Carrick was there.
Carrick is there.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at this same time on these same radio stations, if they still exist, and on your audio device of choice whenever you want it. Email address for this program, your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts and the playlist of the music heard here on, all at harryshearer.com. My thanks as always to Professor Gary Marcus for helping to prick the hype balloon. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy Radio Network. So long from the Crescent City.